And I remember like going through a depressive episode of constantly just crying about 3 to 4 days a week. And I would constantly question, like, what would it be like if I wasn't here? Like, what is my purpose? Like, what would the world look like without Raven?
That's two-time Olympic shot putter Raven Saunders, and she's my guest on this episode of No Off Season. I'm Dr. Shairi Turner. When it comes to mental health, Raven Saunders believes in transparency. During our time together, she shared the factors that shape her mental health. We discussed Raven's challenging childhood in South Carolina and the extreme isolation that she felt after returning from her first Olympics in Rio. Raven also shared a powerful story about the text message that saved her life and ultimately helped her find a path forward. One quick trigger warning, our conversation touches on self-harm and suicidal ideation. Take care of yourself if this is a hard topic for you. If you choose to keep listening, know that you're not alone. Crisis Text Line is always here for support if you need it. It's brave to reach out. At any time, texters in the U.S. can connect with volunteer crisis counselors by texting the word STRONG to 741-741. It's private, free, and 24/7. So Raven Saunders, I am really so honored to be having this conversation about mental health with you. You've shared so freely with so many audiences, but I want to make sure that this audience has the full picture and your full story as well. So I wanted to start by asking about your childhood in South Carolina, Charleston. What we go through as children impact our mental health as adults. And from an early age, you were confronted with a complex set of circumstances, including witnessing the domestic abuse in your own home, understanding at a very young age your sexuality, coming out to your mom in third grade, which is amazing.
Yes.
And then I would imagine just could see like a degree of poverty and community trauma, right? Can you...
Yes.
Help to paint a picture for our audience about your childhood. What was hard? What was meaningful? So
me as a child, I was a very jovial, you know, exciting and honestly like naive kid when it came to a lot of things. I always, you know, would like always expect the best, I feel like, out of people. So when it came to opening up about my sexuality to my mom and even the circumstances that we lived in, it was something that, you know, you kind of kept a lot of things in house. So when I came out about my sexuality, my mom was like, okay, it's a phase. But her boyfriend at the time, my sister's father, read me the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. So that was something I literally kept to myself. And I remember holding that secret until I was kind of forced out of the closet. And then also going through the experiences of poverty. You go out and then you go into school and it's still a competition of who has the best this or who has the best that. And you look around and you're like, well, I'm not that. So that's another thing against me. And then, you know, from the standpoint of witnessing domestic abuse, I was a kid and family is very important to me. Grew up around my family, close-knit, always, no matter where we stayed, we were always coming together for holidays. But witnessing that was something for me that was very defeating, even as a child, because you always want the best for your family. And there was one particular instance where I remember grabbing my little sister out of the bed and running to the bathroom, but my mom was still out there. And you feel helpless. And for me, that was something that I held on to, especially because at that time I was about 12, 13. So going into high school, it was something I held on to. I never wanted to feel helpless again. I never wanted to feel the way that I felt out of control. And a lot of those moments when it came to, you know, opening up about my sexuality or being in circumstances living that I didn't want to be in, it gave me a craving to want to explore and push the limits.
The other thing I found very moving about your story is how you arrived at your sport career, right? And just hearing you say you never wanted to feel helpless or out of control. And, you know, it sounds like in high school, you started training really to help protect your mom from abuse. And for you, just hearing how sports and trauma were linked from the very beginning, and it was almost happenstance, right, that you found that in doing this and becoming strong, you had the potential to be one of the best shot putters on the planet. But what did that do for the way you saw yourself and your sense of purpose?
It gave my purpose a platform, is what I really felt like, because I really never felt like my purpose was throwing a shot put even after winning my first state championship. I always knew that I wanted to help people, which is why, like, a lot of the times I was like, yo, I want to be a lawyer, because I wanted to create change. But shot put was something that gave me confidence by going into that weight room and outworking every guy inside of there. I don't care what year you were, senior through freshman, you're going to get worked, because it was something that was, you know, bigger than what I saw. It was a method and a means of survival. And once I found a shot put that was, I feel like, tailored towards me, being able to get out a lot of that anger and aggression, being able to travel, being able to see things that I never would have, and meeting people I never would have, it opened my eyes a lot more than a lot of the people that I grew up around, to really also what was capable for me and the kind of change and the amount of people that I really could touch.
One thing you said there that was important, I think, that we touch on is like that moment of like looking forward and seeing all that comes with, you know, being first a champion in college, in high school.
Oh, yeah.
And then in the Olympics, but also knowing like who's home, right? Who's still there behind, kind of waiting for you. And how did you reconcile, how did you kind of deal with that constant pull between home is one space, and I can imagine being an Olympiad is just a whole like head spinning change from that, right?
Yeah. Oh no, it was completely different, be it, you know, being at this level and being able to accomplish so much and compete at my sport at the highest level versus being in a space to where it was just a pull. I knew that I had to be up at 5 o'clock in the morning running before school. I had to do 1,000 push-ups in a week because it was bigger than me. I knew that my mom couldn't afford to send me off to college across the country if that's what I decided. But I knew that she wanted the best for me. A lot of kids, when you talk about sport, always talked about, I want to get my mom in the house. And that was my idea. I knew that especially doing shot put that wasn't a mainstream sport or a mainstream event, that I would need to do this not just at a high level, but completely different than many other people. So that was a lot of pressure to take on, but it was a challenge that, being young and naive, it helps. Yeah. It helps so much.
Yeah, I hear that drive to survive, right? Like,
yes.
It's more than just a drive to win. You hear and know in the back of your mind that winning is survival, right? It's survival,
yes,
for you and so many in your family and community. So let's talk about this Hulk persona, right? So that emerged. And so share with us a little bit about how that emerged, but also in that same moment, if you share about where did the child Raven go when the Hulk became sort of that forefront persona for you?
I feel like the child Raven was always like there. The Hulk was a way for me to kind of channel a lot of that energy and frustration into one thing. So a lot of the problems that I was dealing with, I could escape by going to the Hulk. So just like how, you know, he would get all riled up and then he'd turn green, that was me. But once he understood that I have to channel this for a purpose and for a reason to do something good with it, that's what I did. So when I picked up the name, it was in a midst of just like chaos, like, okay, I'm the Hulk, like rah, rah, rah. And, you know, even to the standpoint of certain times being self-destructive. And you know, that's the reality of it. But once I learned myself, learned who I was and where I need to Hulk out at, it was that transformation was so nice.
Let's jump to the 2016 Rio Games, right? It was a very high pressure situation. You're a sophomore. I remember being we're still, you know, sophomores. We think we're old, right? Because we're not freshmen.
Think so. Right. 19 going on 20.
Right.
Yeah.
And you talk about just summoning that strength for those big throws, right? And kind of we talked about like looking forward, reaching back, right? It sounds like you had to reach back into some tough moments and pull that forward to succeed, right? To really push through. Talk a little bit about that feeling.
Man, I could even describe it to you like through how that meet went. The first throw was like a nice lineup. And in the second throw, the shot put like popped out of my neck. Foul. Like, didn't even get a chance to throw it. And throw 3, 4, 5, I'm sitting there and my mind is all over the place. And I'm trying to find, like, you know, what it is that I need to do, trying to find my focus and something to get me back on track. And it was at that moment that I literally remember looking up into the stands and watching my mom, my sister, and my aunt. And thinking to myself, I have to show her what is capable. Because she was also doing the exact same sport. And then I was like, my mom is here. Like, I have to show her what she did, what she made. And understanding that and just calming down and realizing I have it. It's inside of me. I just have to relax and stop putting all of the pressure on myself and just do what I do. And that's really what got me through that competition is, like you said, going back, remembering my why, settling down inside of myself and buckling down and making it happen.
And seeing the sacrifice, right, that your mom had gone through.
Yes.
To get you to that point, to be with you through that point.
My mother had never been out of the country at that point. My little sister had never been on an airplane.
Yeah.
On a plane, period. And her first trip was out of the country to Rio, Brazil.
Yeah.
And like the love that my city showed to us, like, because my mom was working like literally paycheck to paycheck at Krispy Kreme. So having that opportunity and watching that, even me as a broke college kid with no money,
right,
and watching what I'm still able to provide for my family, it really gave me insight to what's really out there and what I can do to really change the people, you know, in my family. And even the people around the world.
Yeah. So when you came back from Rio, it was a lot, right? There was a parade and celebration and you're 20 and you're Olympiad and a super high, right? Like incredible experience,
yes.
I would imagine. But as all incredible experiences do, it came to an end, right? The celebration, the celebration was huge.
Yes.
But then again, it's that like who I was and who I am and who's at home. What I remember in listening to some of your other interviews is that contrast of like everyone expecting, like, your life is great, right, Raven? Like, right, you're the Hulk, you're top in your field, but not. Right? Why then after that, when it got quiet, when an understanding about your mental health came to you in that moment, what changed after Rio for you?
What changed after Rio for me was that sports has always been my escape. I've always used sports as an escape from a lot of things. And there was a lot that was going on in Mississippi at the time, be it I'm gay, black, and we're doing Confederate statue debates. We're having KKK rallies, and mentally it was already a lot. So that year, having the track season I had a chance to escape all of these things, and I'm on my own whirlwind parade. You get back home, you're still go, 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 go. So I didn't have a chance to sit mentally with what it was that I was going on, I had going on. I left the Olympics about maybe like 5 days early, so I didn't get a chance to fully experience it because the head coach was also my head coach, and she's like, well, you got school. I'm like, in my head, I'm like, man, I'm at the Olympics, yo. Like, I don't want to go back.
A lifetime.
Like, Right. But so I had to go back, but I had the parade. And literally when I tell you the next day after the parade, I was on a flight back to Mississippi. And the following day I was sitting in a class for the first day of school. And it was like I had no breathing room because granted I had 2 weeks off of training, but I don't have off because I still have to go to class. I have my tutors that I have to go to. I have other meetings and things like that. Then I have media that I'm required to do because, you know, I just came back from the Olympics and for the school. So they have things that they want from me. And it really was no breathing room. I'm in class. My teacher's like using me as an example, which that was nice. But it still was like no one's really like asking you like, you know, are you okay? And for me, it got to a point to where like I just mentally checked out for a while. And I was like, I'm here. Nobody really cares. Because at the time, I was the only one on my track team really doing what I was doing. No one really cares about me as a person. The things that I am passionate about, being in this space, no one really cares about. The things that are personal to me. So it really made me question myself a lot. And that was something that up until that point I was so secure in. And it was a very, very difficult transition. And that was something also that no one really talked about or prepared you for after an Olympics, of building up a such high and all of the things that you have to prep for and prepare for afterwards. Which is why like I knew that after everything like calmed down and things got quiet for me after like this past Olympics, man, I was on cruises. I made sure I took time for myself because I can't allow for my mental to go back to that. So it was definitely a learning experience.
Just listening to you in that, from the Olympics to the classroom, jarring is what comes to mind, right? Just absolutely jarring to your entire system. I'm just hearing it. I'm like,
yes. And no one thought anything of it. And it was like, I was expected to go to class. And it was like the day. And I remember it was like within the first 2 weeks, like I take a day off of class or like, yo, I'm not going to this tutor because I like just had I'm sweaty from practice. I haven't had any time off for real. And no, I'm not going. And then you get blown up. And I'm like, you lose your passion for it because it's no longer, it's too much. It's too much.
Just lonely too, I would imagine, right? You're surrounded by people, but simultaneously all alone in that space because no one's really connecting to your experience with you or about you.
Right.
And I know you've been so wonderfully vocal. And when I say wonderfully, I mean just insofar as every time we share, anyone shares about a experience of suicide or suicidal ideations, it gives support and hope to others who struggle with it. And you've been vocal about that period and just talking about that drive, like you've brought that drive just to life in the way that you describe it so that we can almost see it. Was that the first time you had ever thought about harming yourself?
No, not at all. I remember a time period actually when I was battling with my sexuality in like middle school, like after being like this whole crazy episode of being like forced out of the closet in elementary and then being re-brought back out of the closet in sixth grade, middle school, where I went through a period of like cutting as really I found out a lot of kids did and slash still do as a way to feel physical pain that you could feel versus that internal pain that was something that was different. So for me, it was something I had never dealt with or processed or acknowledged that I really kept to myself, that it became like a snowball. I mean, and then I looked through high school and I remember like going through a depressive episode of constantly just crying about 3 to 4 days a week and like just going through the motions. And then again, my freshman year of college, where I would constantly question like, what would it be like if I wasn't here? Like, what is my purpose? Like, what would the world look like without Raven? And being like, well, maybe it would be a better place. And the snowball continued, especially after accomplishing and getting to a level where we all talk about, hey, if I only had this much money, if I only had this job, if I only had this house, if I only had this car, well, if only I was an Olympian, that my life would change forever. I would have no problems. I would have no worries. And then you realize that life hits at that moment when everything that you've prayed for and manifested, you finally get, and then you realize you still have to keep doing work. And that was the thing for me, that finally when I came to what I talk about, like, you know, my personal intersection of, you know, the actual moment where I was ready to commit suicide, where at that point I had let too much stuff build up and I hadn't created enough things around me to help build up my own system to help me out.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important part of your story, right? Because we hear the part where you were on that drive and considering driving off the embankment, but for folks who've struggled with suicide, it's going back and seeing those other points in time where someone, you know, could have helped, or you could have reached out, or, you know, just not knowing, but knowing that it's for people who don't understand, right? That
right.
It's not just a,
it never just happens. Like, you right. never, like, suicide isn't something that, like, when someone does it, it just happened. They're like, I'm doing it today and that's it. There's always signs, or there's always moments or something prior to, maybe you don't know it, or maybe you don't pay attention to it, that has led up to it. Because the amount of strength that it takes to even do that, and all the things that comes with it mentally, it's prepped. There's things that come before it. There's prerequisites, and that's really how it goes.
Yeah, it's like fighting the darkness day by day, right?
And it got darker.
Yeah, because does it feel like, who am I, right, to have this darkness when I am so fortunate?
Yeah, I felt guilty.
Yes.
I felt guilty. You get to a place and it's wild, because you're like, everyone's telling you all of this and you're looking around and you're like, well, I have all of these things to be fortunate for, but why am I not happy? Like, what is wrong with me? Like, something, and then you start internalizing it and beating up on yourself even worse than you already had before, because now something really has to be wrong, because I'm not even enjoying the things that people would literally die for.
And I know, you know, as you were making that drive, it was a text to your therapist that ultimately saved your life. And, you know, for us, as this was particularly moving, as we're part of Crisis Text Line, right? And all we do is crisis support and intervention by text. And you didn't call your therapist. You did text. Tell me a little bit about that. How did that, what was kind of that decision in your head?
So we all go through a phase where, like, sometimes you know what you want to say, but you don't know how to say it, or you can't bring the words that you want up to your mouth. It's literally like a blockage where it's like you open up and your chest will, like, come back down, like, no, and it'll suppress all of the words. Like, I couldn't speak at that point. I'm literally just in a daze driving. So texting was the only way that I felt like I could somehow get out how I felt to someone who, let's speak about that connection, because even for me with her, it was like, it was just a connection from, she also grew up with drug abuse and step parents and alcoholism in her home. So we had made a connection, and so that was like somebody for me. Like, I just was like, all right, cool, whatever. I'm just gonna shoot this text however I feel, because I knew she knew all, whatever I had, I was just ready to be like, just let it all out. I was completely vulnerable. Laid it all out on the table. Hey, this is how I feel. Pretty much in code, you know, how it goes. But her being a therapist, knowing how wording goes, yo, some red flag, foul in a play. I need you to go home right now. Like, I'm going to get you some help. And just hearing that, especially being in that place, really changed my life. And I really talk about, like, being lucky from the standpoint of, she didn't have to text back. She could have changed her number. she wasn't being paid by the university to be my therapist anymore. So I really was lucky from the standpoint of that working for me, and hearing stuff like crisis text line, man, it blows my mind, because more people need that access, just knowing, because you can't, calling in sometimes it's not enough. Just being able to write out and say whatever it is that's on your heart and just get it all off and just have somebody tell you, you got this, like, you're okay, I promise you, you're worthy, you know, you're smart, like anything to just kind of pick up your spirits, to give you some form of hope or show you some form of light, even if it's just a twinkle in the midst of all of that darkness, can really ignite like gasoline that you may have had laying around you that you never saw. And that was the thing for me, man. That oh gosh, I'm still thankful to her to this day, and yeah. I'll still message her thanking her for saving my life. Like,
yeah, well, it's that powerful connection, even yes. through really the powerful connection through words, right? In that moment, you didn't even need necessarily to hear her voice to know right. that she was there with you, right?
I just needed to know powerful. That there was somebody there.
Somebody there.
Somebody needed to be there. That's, and man, a lot of times that's all you really need.
Tell us a little bit about what she did in that moment, and then what happened right after that.
So she went through like the protocol. So she talked to me. So I got home. She called me. She was like, "Hey, Raven, I'm gonna get you some help. I've contacted the trainers and stuff at the school, and that they were gonna handle it." She was like, "Yo, stay in contact if you need anything else or whatever." So I got a contact from one of the head trainers to come down to school. I got a chance to sit down and really just open up to them, also like judgment free, whatever, in that moment. And really, they got me the best help possible. They gave me the option to go inpatient or outpatient, which I feel like that's also another big topic when we talk about mental health, when it comes to inpatient and outpatient and choice. But I had the choice, and I chose to go, and it was the best decision of my life, though, because I personally was in a space to where I had just given up, so that I was so open and so vulnerable that I was willing to lay out everything on the table, that I could go back and backtrack all of those childhood traumatic events throughout my life that I had pretty much sucked up and charged it as, well, this is just how life goes. In order to be strong, I have to swallow these things and keep moving. And it's about how much I can add onto my plate and still keep pushing. Whereas I got there, and it was like I got to take off all of these bags and take out all of these weights that I'd been holding. And it felt like I could breathe. Like the sigh of relief from releasing all of that trauma and learning myself, learning the signs of, this is what depression looks like for me, not for someone else, but this is what my depression looks like. These are the signs that I need to look out for. These are the people that I need to call. These are the methods that I need to work on. I need to make sure that I meditate. I need to make sure that if I'm in a certain place, I call my therapist. And just having the time to learn that was life-changing. And when I speak about, like, you know, these are the things that I do, I don't want anybody to take on those things and be like, okay, this is a quick fix and my mental is going to be perfect. Because one, those are my tools. And two, I am still battling this thing to this day. And just because I look good and I may smile and I may dance, it is still an ongoing battle. But I'm here to tell people, this battle and this journey, it is beautiful and it is worth the fight day in and day out, even in the tough moments.
And then by the time the Tokyo Games started in 2021, you had started to step into the role of activist, right? And one of the things I noticed is in your role as the Hulk and your role of a protector, and it's evolved, but I see your protector persona first for your mom, and then, you know, in Tokyo, with your stance, just protection of people of color and people who are oppressed, and then protection of the LGBTQ community. and then protection of people who suffer from mental illness. It just sounds like those are just key to who you have evolved to become. Does that resonate for you?
It's exactly what it is. I feel like as I've gotten stronger and I've grown stronger, my old man would always tell me, my high school coach, he would always tell me, stay in your lane, which is, you know, sports wise, compete, you know, don't bite off too much that you can chew. And I feel like when it comes to my growth from the standpoint of trying to do that with like people and even my mental, it's kind of been the same thing. The stronger I've gotten, the more people I'm trying to touch, the more people I'm trying to help and protect. And Tokyo was definitely like the full circle moment of that. The confidence of knowing who I was without it, being confident that even in this moment, if this doesn't work out, I'm still going to be happy. I'm still going to be dancing. I'm still going to be smiling. I'm still going to be me. I still have to enjoy life, you know, because life is still going to go on.
It feels like it wasn't just an empowering moment for when you stood there and crossed your arms, that it wasn't just an empowering moment, a demonstration of power for those who are oppressed, those of us just racial oppression, but it was also a sign of empowerment for you and who you had evolved to be.
Yes. Hands down. Oh, gosh, hands down.
That's a relationship between managing, you know, the protection of others, the protection of self, your own mental health, the mental health of others. How do you now find that strength to do that?
I have to be really mindful of yourself. And I've had to learn to do that in certain moments where I get uncomfortable, or I start to, you know, feel a certain way, or my depression starts to waver. I have to sit and analyze the things around me, what I'm doing, and what may be causing these things. So it helps me out to find certain triggers and navigate myself so that now it's not even, well, I find it like funny where I'm like, oh, there we go. Like, that's it. Hey girl, my depression about to come up. And I will literally call my friends out, like maybe like a certain time period before I feel these things coming on. So really just being mindful of recognizing the signs.
That's so, so important, because what you do, even like in your friendship circles, and then also just broadly and publicly by raising your voice and talking about, you know, this about depression and suicide and self-acceptance, it's that destigmatization. It's normalizing that conversation. What would you say just to the general public? Why do we have to get rid of these stigmas? Why must these stigmas be gone? Why is it so important that everybody speak and normalize this?
We have to normalize it because the amount of damage that we have done to the mental health community from the standpoint of visual mental health disabilities that we've been able to see, and categorizing and generalizing the ones that you can't in a negative light, which none of it should be in a negative light. We have to start changing that conversation. We have to be more open so that we can understand, so that the people who are struggling have an open space. Because even if we look at our friendship groups, I'm pretty sure conversations that you've had around mental health, if you backtrack 10 years, shoot, maybe even 5, that conversation would never be coming about. And now seeing people that we call our friends or my best friend and having a deeper insight to that, for humanity, it's just going to make us better.
Yes. Yes. I love it. A moment that really touched me was the loss of your mom, right? Right after you won that silver medal in Tokyo, right after that very powerful moment. I'm so sorry for your loss, because I could tell in the interview that I saw with her and your sister just how much of a supporter. You called her your guardian angel.
Yes.
Yeah. And I, you know, I don't think we ever get over those losses, right?
No.
But you can't, right? Because she was such a powerful part of who you are, who you were, and who you are. what are the tools that you use, right? So in the good times, you're good. In those yes. times when either your mom's loss or other factors play into your mental health, what are some of the tools that you use? And I think what's important, you said before about the tools you use may not work for others,
yeah.
but I think it's always an opportunity to share yes. if you'd like, if you would.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I have to talk to her. There'll be like moments even when things are good, but when they're bad, I'll talk. Shoot, saying things like, how could you leave me like this? Saying those hard things that you internalize and you want to say, but you don't speak out. It's another form of holding things in. So I find that talking out is a great way to get out a lot of those feelings. Right, literally the next morning, because I found out at night, the next morning I had booked a therapy session. I always suggest people to go seek therapy, especially right after a major loss, you must, because the amount that I was able to get out in a setting, man, it was the best thing possible. And then even taking the time to really appreciate all of the lessons that she taught me. So when I do have a moment where I'm like down and out, and I mean, I could be boohoo crying on the floor, I'll just hear a voice like, get up, like kick ass, which is what she'd tell me every time before every major track meet. And just knowing the strength of, you know, what she was able to do, having arthritis, having two kids, having, you know, boyfriends that, you know, domestic, dealing with all of these things and still wanting more for her daughters and making sure that happened and seeing those things come to light shows me that if I stick this thing out, like there's so much greater on that other side if I just keep pushing, just keep fighting.
That was Raven Saunders. Please come back next time when my co-host, Natalia Diane, sits down with marathon champion and double amputee, Marco Chisetto. They'll talk about the hard work of establishing a positive outlook on life after enduring extreme loss. This has been No Off Season. I'm Dr. Shairi Turner. The information and opinions provided on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. We encourage you to speak with your doctor for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.